When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I am convinced that they did some kind of weird vocal effect. The ability is to tune, T-U-N-E. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know if people just chose or were directed to pronounce it weird, or if they did something with like
tune
tape or something like that. But like, throughout the movie, I can't tell. Is it tune? Is it cune? Is it, you know, he can coon. Like, there's so many, like, various pronunciations. I think you get one clean, he can tune in the movie. I think the
probably
rest
from Kiefer.
Yeah, I think the rest
tuning.
Yeah, but he does. But most of the time when he does it, he does this weird inflection. He can tune. And you're on Midnight Local, the podcast from How to Drink, where we just talk about things.
Movies.
Pop culture.
Maybe some video games.
That too. All the things.
Things, the stuff and things.
All of the stuff and the things on Midnight Local.
Let's get to it.
Meredith, I made you watch this movie for the show, and I said we would do this and made you watch it before I had rewatched it. And at that point, I had committed you, and I was rewatching it, and I was rewatching it like this, just like, I'm so embarrassed that I told her how much I loved this movie because it felt horny as fuck watching it again.
Well, I will say I thank you because I watched this movie in college. And also, I'll let you off the hook here. Remember really liking it because in the past couple of years, I forgot the name of it. Like, we watched it at a friend's house with a group of people. And I've started to be like, what was that movie? And I keep trying to find it. I've like texted a friend who was like, we watched a million movies. What the hell are you talking about? I couldn't remember who was in it. Why? I don't know. Nothing. And this is it.
Dark City.
Didn't live up to the hype that I had had for it in my brains. But I also watched the director's cut. I wonder if the director's cut is worse than theatrical.
I read about that. So first off, because I don't think we hit this, we are talking about Dark City.
Yeah.
The movie that we're having around here is Dark City. So I definitely did not see the director's cut prior. I'd only ever seen the theatrical cut.
Yeah. You
know, on a VHS I got in 1999 or whatever. I think I saw it in the theater actually, but go on.
Yeah. I mean, I watched this in the latest I possibly could have watched it was 2004. So there's no way I saw the director's cut.
And the director's cut came out in 2008. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't remember exactly the differences. The big difference is that the theatrical cut opens with a monologue from Kiefer Sutherland's character that like sets up the world.
Like Blade Runner-esque.
Yeah, well, it doesn't open on it. It actually opens on apparently like the one review I said is like, man, that shot should have been in the movie. It was like a city streets with everybody asleep.
Oh, okay.
And it was really ominous. And like that was a great opener. But it also included a voiceover from Kiefer Sutherland explaining the setting, kind of ruining that.
Is the voiceover talked like this the entire time?
And they could tune. And he's like always taking those like gasps of breath.
They're like, what a performance. I'm like, he just paused every two words.
Did people say what a performance?
Yes. People were really surprised by this performance out of Kiefer Sutherland.
Well,
in a good way.
Yeah, because he's playing a weak character and he doesn't, that's not like.
And I mean, this was, sure, whatever. But
he plays sexy vampire man. So.
And Jack Bauer.
Way before Jack Bauer. This is way before Jack Bauer.
Not that far before. 3-4 years.
He still looks like a boy in this, but I guess that's true.
Jack Bauer was 2002, maybe?
Yeah, probably was. So I saw this movie before The Matrix, and for me, I loved this movie, and The Matrix felt kind of like a less neat ripoff in a lot of ways. At the time. Now I think of this as Goth Matrix. I guess Matrix is Cyberpunk Matrix. This is Goth Matrix.
Got it.
Right? I think so.
Yeah, because this isn't really, this doesn't focus on the technology in the way that The Matrix does.
No, there's it's really, there, there's no, we don't, it seems like arcane.
It's magic. And, it could be magic.
It's magic. They have some kind of machine that focuses their power, but like,
right.
It's like a face and clock gears and stuff.
Right. Like this is, okay, we'll get to it. I don't want to like give the big reveal at the end, but.
We should set it up. Rufus Sewell wakes up in the bath.
Okay. You want to do the walkthrough first?
Well.
I have to imagine most people haven't seen this movie. So no. Let's walk through what is Dark City.
I think probably most people have not seen this movie, actually. I think this is a mostly forgotten film. So Dark City, it's Rufus Sewell. First off, I love Rufus Sewell. Man does not get enough work. I think he's really good. I don't know if there's some like closet skeleton in his closet where he can't work or something, but like the guy's awesome in everything I've seen him in. Really enjoy seeing him in things. Love him.
Mm-hmm.
He wakes up in the bath in like a shitty looking motel. The light won't stop swinging. He cuts his foot. I think there's broken glass. He saves a drowning fish. He tries to leave. He leaves. Everything is really crazy. He finds a corpse. He finds a dead woman who's been carved up.
She's got spirals carved into her. Can I, one more thing that I want to lay out there before we get into this is that, and also to let you off the hook of how much you liked it. Roger Ebert called this the best film of 1998.
It might have been.
And went as far as to record, he recorded a special audio commentary track for the DVD release of the movie.
I want that. I gotta see that. I would watch that right now. That's insane.
So people loved it.
Oh my God. Wow. I did not know that. Yeah. So. That's good. So
it's worth covering for that reason as an unknown movie, but we both feel differently about it now. Anyway,
it's really inventive.
Give us some credibility here.
Really cool and ideas and an aesthetic that I don't think you saw anywhere else. Like, right? Like, the city is cool. Like, the dark city is fucking cool looking. It's very, this noir kind of Art Deco vibes are really cool. The sets are cool. The characters feel cool. All of that is true, right? And like, to my point about The Matrix, that's the part of The Matrix I like the best. Act one. And this is just all in that world, right?
Well, so, and actually the rooftop chase scene, because this was shot in Australia as well, they sold a lot of those set pieces to The Matrix, and they shot a lot of that opening scene using these set pieces.
Oh my God. Well, so there you go.
Brings it full circle.
Wow. No wonder it's the same set. It's literally the same sets.
You're like, that's the set I like.
And on top of that, it's got some crazy ideas about like, you know what I mean? Like this is a high concept movie. That's high concept. I think that it's so angsty and like, morose that it's like, okay, this is kind of corny and shit. And Kiefer Sutherland is real hard to take seriously. It's a lot. His performance is very extra in this movie. He could have toned it down just a little tiny bit, a little bit.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the synopsis. I thought it was worth laying out that there is some critical acclaim for this movie.
No,
some
it
very
is
high
worth it.
Praise.
I feel great. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So he's John Murdoch. He wakes up, no memories, dead woman in the room, carved up body. He gets a call from Dr. Daniel Schreiber, who is Kiefer Sutherland. And he tells him, listen, you got to get out of there. You got to meet me. I'm going to help you. You got to watch out for the strangers, stranger danger.
Which is a corny name, the strangers.
Yeah. And on top of that, I had a friend, our mutual friend, Ari. I grew up in a modern Orthodox house, and he's just like, it doesn't look like my relatives, you know, because they're basically kind of like dressed like Orthodox Jews.
They also look like,
he loved this movie too, though, as another good goth.
Yeah. Another episode of Buffy. This reminds me a lot of, or the strangers do, is, called Hush, where the bad guys are the gentlemen. who are played by mime actors, and they're pale and bald, and they look like they just have this smile on their face, and they float instead of walk. So,
So needless to say, there are spooky dudes in long coats in this movie.
Yeah, and hats.
And hats, yeah. Large hats. So if you find out that he is suspected of a bunch of murders, like a series of homicides.
But as he's running away from the strangers, you also, like, he realizes that everyone in the hotel has been put to sleep. Like, are sleeping as he walks out.
That's right. Yeah. And he talks to the guy at the front desk, right, when he comes back. And then later it's a different guy at the front desk.
Well, actually, yeah, he talks to the guy at the front desk. And later the front desk guy is at a hot dog cart.
That's what it is. Yeah. Okay.
Which, not that crazy of a difference. Maybe he's got a night job, but yeah.
I swear he goes back to the front desk. It's a different guy. And he's like, but he's the same guy. Like, he's saying the exact same thing. Am I wrong? Or maybe he has a memory of a different front desk guy is what it
maybe.
Is.
Maybe. Yeah. But I do know they really lay it out for you, because you see the front desk guy at the hot dog cart. He's having this realization that things have changed. And
sure.
Flashes back to an image of him sitting at the front desk. We're like, no, we got it. We got it.
Well, he doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know who he is. He finds his name from his driver's license, which he does not have access to. He gets a call. There's a message for him at the front desk that they have your wallet at the automat. And so he goes to the automat. By the way, I didn't know what an automat was when I saw this movie, but I thought it was really cool when I saw it, and I wanted to go to one. I found out that they're not that cool, actually, in reality. It's just stale food that's cheap.
It also is like he sees Jay Murdoch, so he's kind of trying out like Jack, John, Jerry.
All the different first names. Yeah.
Yeah.
Forgot about that. That's a great beat. Gets his wallet, and then he's being kind of accosted by the cops needlessly, because I don't know. He doesn't look like a derelict or anything. The cops are giving him a real hard time.
Why are they accusing... Oh, it's not until they find the body in the room he was in that they start to suspect him of the series of murders of sex workers.
Yeah, they don't know it's him at all, or it might be him.
And yeah, we'll get to it later, but I don't really understand why they were framing him of these murders.
Well, we can get to that. So we can talk about that in a minute. So spoiler, he's not a murderer, since you used the word framing.
He thinks he might be. Yeah, he's not sure at this point if he is or not.
He goes home with a sex worker to her place. You're not really sure what's going to happen. He's not really sure what's going to happen. He did just leave a room with a dead sex worker. I feel so weird just saying sex worker, sex worker, sex worker. I want to say other things so badly.
Say what you want to say.
Say what you want to say. Just say it. Just say it. No, and he doesn't kill anybody. She's got a kid there. He just leaves. And she's bummed because she doesn't make any money. It's a bad time for her. The movie then changes focus to her, and it's entirely about her trying to make ends meet. This guy, John Murdoch, is nowhere to be seen. No, I think at that point he does have a run-in with the strangers. Is that when it happens? I forget.
Yeah, I think so at the top. Well, because he sees the Shell Beach and has a flashback to a memory of himself on a pier.
Yes.
I don't know why he climbs up to it.
Up on the thing.
There's a reason. I don't know. There was a reason for it.
Spooky dudes show up. He does something magic with his hands. One of them gets their head crushed and freaks out, and like some weird ghost spider crawls out of his skull.
Yeah, like the floor sort of disappears and they fall through it.
Yeah, and then they get away. He gets away. It's a big deal. Okay, we keep going back to like this weird nightmare place that's like underground or something with a giant face head. And all of these stranger dudes hanging out, and they make chittering noises. They're real gross. And there's much consternation amongst the strangers about this man who was awake, right?
Right.
I don't know.
How he has some abilities that they have mastered, so, that humans couldn't possibly master.
I am convinced that they did some kind of weird vocal effect. The ability is to tune, T-U-N-E. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know if people just chose or were directed to pronounce it weird, or if they did something with like
tune
tape or something like that. But like, throughout the movie, I can't tell, is it tune? Is it cune? Is, you know, he can coon. Like, there's so many, like, various pronunciations. I think you get one clean, he can tune in the movie. I think the
probably
rest
from Kiefer.
Yeah, I think the rest
tuning.
Yeah, but he does. But most of the time when he does this weird inflection. He can, and it's just so hard to understand. That's what's being said. I also think that in many cases it's being thrown through like a ring modulator or something, some kind of an effect, a phaser or something, like a tape distortion, tape delay.
We also somewhere in here get the information that the strangers don't like water. They can't handle water.
Oh, I forget that. Does that ever come up again in the movie?
I don't think so. But well, kind of, because that's what he adds to the environment. Well, we'll get there. But yes.
Well, that's why Kiefer's character, what's his damn name?
Dr. Schreiber.
He hangs out at the like Russian bathhouse because they don't like water, but then they come in and fuck with him anyway. So I don't, they might not like it, but they don't, it's not going to kill them.
I don't know if they fell into it. We don't know, but the humidity isn't
their dislike of it. It doesn't rise above general dislike. You know? I'd rather not.
He explains it again later in the movie, but yeah, we know water is a weakness.
And so from there, he's running around. William Hurt, not John Hurt, who was discussed in the most recent movie. Bill Hurt is a cop who's hunting him. His wife is Jennifer Connelly. She's really concerned that he's a murderer. She doesn't think he's a murderer. She's a jazz singer badly.
And she's cheated on him. So she just hasn't worried about his disappearance because she thought he just left her because she revealed that she had cheated on him.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. You also find out that there's a former detective who had been working the case who has gone crazy.
Right. He's like drawing these spirals.
Spirals. And I don't think we need to go beat by beat except to say that it's a chase. He finds out a lot about himself. Like, interspersed with all of this stuff that's going on in this movie, we get to see what the strangers are doing. They put this is what they do every night.
Go ahead.
If I can do a Trump accent, Trump voice, because like the way I said that, this is what they do every night. I don't know why that seems like something. This is what they do every night. Every night, they put the whole city to sleep. And then they rearrange the city and they grow new buildings. They shrink others. They push buildings together. The whole city is like Play-Doh. Yeah. It's elastic. They change it around.
And then certain people get these shots in their head, which puts new memories, new thoughts, new personas in there.
There's a great sequence where you see like this couple having kind of like the same old, this like working class couple in their shitty little apartment, having that same old fight, yabbering at each other. And then they fall asleep. And then the strangers come in and they like make the room bigger and they make them wealthy. You know, the room gets huge, it turns into a ballroom. They change their clothing. Now they're sitting at this long table.
I think he's griping about work when they like, but his boss or whatever.
And then they wake them up and they have a whole new life that's they have always had.
But he's still griping about work. He's just complaining about how he's got to fire someone for some reason. She's agreeing with him. Yeah.
Exactly. Like it's a change of status. And so
you realize something's gone wrong when they did that to Murdoch.
Murdoch wasn't asleep.
Okay.
He didn't fall asleep.
He's got a little blood on his forehead. He
knocked the syringe out of his hand.
So it didn't fully take, which is why
exactly
he's woken up with split eye memories and stuff.
So Dr. Schreiber is a human who knows how to mix up people's memories into a drug and inject them. And he's got like all of these extracts where he's like, there's a scene later in the movie. He's like, we'll just take a little of a traumatic childhood and a little of this. And he can like put these things together and inject them with you. And so what they do every night is they rearrange a city and they rearrange people and lives and they swap this person with that person, or they take some new invented set of memories and they take this person and move them into this life and give them new memories. And so what they were attempting to do with John Murdoch was turn him into, see what would happen if they set him up to be a serial killer. They put him into the life of a serial killer. They injected the thoughts of a serial killer. Will he keep killing? Or is that something that is not just the sum of your memories? It's your soul. Because that we find out, and we define this out quick, by the way, this isn't too much of a spoiler. Like Kiefer's like wheezing this into our faces all the way through the movie.
Yeah. How long has this city been there?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, right. That they've not run this experiment before or whatever.
Well, it could have been forever. It could have been a week. Yeah. Because nobody has any memories.
Sort of figures out that he's not a murderer.
You find out that, sorry, my point that I got derailed on. He explains that the strangers, we don't know where they came from, but their people are dying. And they need to understand the soul because they have a collective consciousness, like a collective soul, which doesn't make sense though, because they also have conversations. So they have some kind of, they have a collective set of memories, but they still have to talk about it with each other. I don't know. But they need to understand our soul because our individuality is what makes us what they need to acquire. Look, it's thin. That's a really thin idea. I'm not going to lie. It doesn't make any goddamn sense. It made a lot of sense to me when I was 17 or 16 or 15, whenever I saw this.
But, or it didn't need to make sense to you at that time.
Because it just so cool looking. Like it
looked cool and there were boobies.
There's not many boobies in this.
Enough.
There's some dead lady boobs.
And then you see also the woman he goes home with.
Oh, as I say, I was about to freak out. I was like, Meredith, did you tell me I missed out on Jennifer Connelly's boobs?
Wait a second.
I
got to
go watch this movie five more times. Hold on. which goes without saying, Jennifer Connelly is in this movie. And in the director's cut, I think that you said, we find out that she can't sing because the theatrical.
She's not that bad, but yeah, she's not like tone deaf or anything. She's just not. But yeah, in theatrical release, they replaced her voice with a professional singer.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Jennifer Connelly doesn't need to sing, but she can't.
Which, too long. Those scenes of her in the nightclub singing, it's just too long.
So long.
Unnecessary.
So long. They are.
they do it's nothing just, for the movie.
No, there's a, well, they do. There's a lot of mood setting.
It's fine. It's mood setting, sure.
Yeah. One thing that jumps right out at you. I don't know, me, watch this movie again, is, did you really take notice of Daniel, Dr. Schreiber's psychiatry office?
No.
It's the most insane room. He lives, his office is like, I don't know, like an Art Deco, like astronomy observatory or something. Mm. It's like this crazy space. It looks like something out of Batman Returns.
Well, I know they worked really hard to make to throw you off for any sort of time period, to make any, you know, to mix it up from set to set and to have certain types of phones and certain types of analog things so that you didn't really weren't able to place a time.
Well, that's kind of actually, that feels a lot like, Batman, the animated series, the Tim Burton Batman movies, and The Matrix. Before we leave The Matrix, it's very strange because there's like computers and like a corporate high-tech world. And then also like really slick 1968 Lincoln cruisers and, rotary dial phones. It's like, you know what I mean? Like it has like that same vibe. That might've just been in the air. It was going around, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Probably because of Batman. Probably Batman set the mold there.
The 90s, the 80s and 90s were kind of like that though, too. It's like our basement, we had a rotary phone, but we had the internet upstairs. You know, it's like the old stuff got moved downstairs and was still there. And the new stuff got put upstairs.
Our rotary phone was in the kitchen, Meredith.
Yeah.
We
on the wall.
The same. Oh, yeah. With a 40-foot cable.
Mm-hmm.
So you could walk around the house.
Mm-hmm. We had one of those in my early childhood. And then I remember it was such a big deal when we got the portable phones. And then it was such a nuisance because we could never find them around the house. So we always had to hit that button and go find it.
Oh, darn. Here's a weird telephony question for you. Do you know the difference between tone and pulse?
Mm-mm.
So when you, God damn it, I'm such a phone freak nerd. When you turn a rotary dial, it's got a series of contacts that go bip, 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 and that tells the interchange what number you're dialing. You know, that was a 9, that was an 8. They used to call the, you know, modern telephone touch tone dialing. And that was a whole separate system where each button had a tone set to it, which is why we could play music on beep, boop, boop, beep, beep, boop. Each one of those tones would travel up the lines and tell the interchange, hey, this is the number I'm trying to dial. in between there is pulse tone. Well, what if your local interchange didn't have tone dialing yet, but you wanted a phone that you could push buttons on? You'd flip the switch to pulse, and then each button would, it would be a push button that did like it was a rotary phone. Did the same rotary phones out. Anyway, just stupid.
That's cool.
Just I don't know where that came from. Just old phone
some
stuff.
Some phone trivia.
I sometimes I think about getting into collecting old phones.
Sure.
I just seem like a guy who might.
What would you do with them?
Just dab them around.
Would you display them?
Maybe I put one in the set, had a drink.
Sure.
Maybe I'd rig one up as a microphone on my computer, you know, like let the kids play with another one. I got three just there, you know, three old phones right there, right away off the top.
Okay. Wall art. I've seen some people like, yeah, put a bunch of different ones on the wall.
That's cool. We have a gallery now, so.
Yeah. I had a friend. He had a pillar in his apartment. He lived in one of the like lofts in Bushwick, and he had a different phone on every side of it.
That's a good idea. That sounds like a good use for it. I could set them up as an intercom system around the house.
Mm-hmm.
That would be hyper nerdy shit.
Yeah, that would be very nerdy.
That goes way beyond the pale.
you like dial like room 7.
Yes.
Go.
But each one is like different. Like they're all rotary and like, you know, they're all like a vintage antique looking phone.
Right. If I'm your kid, I'm like, how do I use this one? I'm trying to find out where dad is.
If you were my kid, you would know. If you were my kid, you would know.
Sure. You've played with all of the phones.
Yeah, exactly. By that point, we've got all these phones. Whatever. Yeah, and ultimately this movie has to come to a climax, right? He keeps trying to get to Shell Beach. Hey, do you know the way to Shell Beach?
Well, so it's the mystery switches. After he sort of accepts that he's not a murderer, now he's trying to find out who he is.
Right.
And Shell Beach is where he believes he grew up, where he has memories from. So he's on a hunt to try and figure out how to get to Shell Beach.
Right.
Which they've laid down hints that it's like anytime he asks anyone, they're like, oh, you know, you go this way and that, you know, I can't actually remember how you get there.
So that's a big complaint I have for this movie where I say this movie is like hokey, is that there's a number of times where it would have been so much better to be more subtle. When like that is exactly it. And he saw at the cab driver, hey, you wouldn't happen to know the way to Shell Beach. Oh yeah, sure. You just go up that way and then you make a right. And then, you know, it's a funny thing. I can't remember how to get to Shell Beach.
Been a while since I've been there.
He's got to drop that. You know, it's a funny thing. You know, if he had just said, either you take 2nd Ave or maybe it was 7th Street. I forget. Maybe, you know what? Either one. Depends on time of day. You know, just like.
Yeah, sure. Or just know how to get there, but you can't when you try to.
Yeah, well, then that would be, then somebody would try and it'd be really like, wait, that's weird. We can't get here.
But that is what happens.
Yeah, but like, that's what I'm saying is that like, at this point in the movie though, people should just like, they should not know how to get there in a way that doesn't call attention to the fact that they don't know how to get there. That would serve the film better.
Right, because the idea is that, right, yeah, they stretch that a little too thin as well, where it's like, when he finally goes to meet with his uncle that he discovers is still alive and his uncle's showing him slides and he's like, do you remember anything ever happening during the daytime?
Yeah.
It's just like.
And I especially loved that when I was in high school. I still love that idea, but I wanted it to be an almost fourth wall breaking moment where like we as the audience, we needed more time to not question that. Because until somebody says that, are you questioning it? No, you're not questioning it. You're just assuming this is happening kind of in the same, what's going on, you know? And like, it somehow should have gone a little further with that night thing before, like, you know, that should have been like a real 11th hour moment, in my opinion, right?
I was thinking about it before that moment. I wasn't surprised when that became like his way of trying to wake people up of like.
I like that though.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, I don't know. There's like this idea. It reminds me of, I don't think you ever played it, but what's that video game where you go down to that underwater city. It was very popular. Oh, shit.
Mario Brothers.
Yeah, Mario Brothers. That's the one. Rapture is the city. BioShock. In BioShock, like, it's a video game. It's a first-person shooter. And all throughout the game, like in any video game, you get you know, quests. You get assigned, you get missions, right? And you have to beat the level mm-hmm. and get the mission, whatever. And it's kind of this weird meta moment at the end of the game where it's revealed that, like, you never had any, like, of course you didn't have any choice because you're playing a video game, but mm-hmm. like, you never had any choice. Like, you were going to do these things because I have you, like, brainwashed so that when I say, would you kindly, you do whatever I tell you to do next. And so, like, none of these, like, I don't know, it kind of plays with the idea that, like, your assumption about the game is that this is what you've got to do. But in reality, you haven't even been thinking about your actions. You've just been doing them because you're playing a video game, but we can play with that concept. So it's like, you're watching this movie and you're not even thinking about the fact that it's always nighttime. If you're really in the movie, you know, if you're letting it wash over you and calling attention to the fact, it feels kind of like that, like this weird meta, like, we fucked with you kind of moment.
I guess, but it assumes that people never think about their memories
in the setting.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I know they're updating things every so often, but you would think that there would be a time limit of amount of time in each cycle they could get to before people were like, wait a minute, you know, because it's like most of the time you're not doing things. You're just sitting around, especially his uncle who's just sitting there in his apartment and you're just thinking about life, things that have happened, maybe reading a book. And he's not confused by that cycle until someone says to him, you think of a memory. Well, he just never remembers anything?
No, it's when was the last time you remember doing something during the daytime? It's a long time ago. They have memories in the daytime. He's got the pictures even at the end when Kiefer Sutherland gives him the injection to train him on tuning in like 5 minutes. Almost all of those memories happen in the daytime and all the memories people have were programmed by Kiefer Sutherland. So like, it's just that hasn't been in a while that you've done anything in the daytime. It's just kind of like a moment where they're like, oh, that is weird. It's been night for a long time.
Yeah, it's a tough one for me to accept.
And also, you know, it's almost like saying the name of the movie in the movie. Like, it's truly a dark city. This is a dark city.
Right. But they also, like, I don't know. I would find it more believable if, like, they don't know how long they've been in this loop. You know, it's been this one night has lasted for years, decades, however long they need it to. And they're just replaying it for them over and over and over again. But they don't.
You think it's the same night?
No, I don't. That's kind of the problem.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The other big turning point is that one of the strangers injects himself with John Murdoch's memories to help find him. And apparently this is a thing that they've tried before and it always ends in disaster. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the big statement about this movie. So the strangers truly are the sum of their memories. They inject this guy with memories and immediately the memories that were supposed to turn John Murdoch into a serial killer, right? They inject him with those and he's like, he thinks, okay, cool. I'll be able to hunt down John Murdoch. Immediately, his only interest is in killing sex workers. Immediately. Like, and all the other strangers are hanging out. They're like, what the fuck, dude? Jesus Christ. He just starts cutting people up. It instantly turns him into a serial killer. But John Murdoch is a human. He resists that. He questions
the
identity that's been handed to him. He doesn't accept it. And he's dag nabbit, not a serial killer. And that's, like, I think the thesis statement about the movie, I guess, in the movie.
Human men never do horrible things.
You got a one note song, Meredith. You got to learn some other chords here. It's the same thing ever and over.
No,
and
it's
over.
It's just sure. But like, what? That's the message. No, humans couldn't possibly do horrible things.
No, he's. There's no message. He's saying that the film is saying that the defining characteristic of humanity, and from his perspective, is the ability to question the information that we're given, to question our perceptions of reality, to not accept at face value where we are and who we might be, and to redefine who we are.
And the urges we might have.
Saying that you could be handed a place, an identity.
You handed these urges to want to kill.
No, you handed, not urges. He was handed an identity. He was handed memory.
Right.
That's the point. He was handed an identity. And Well, I don't know. I mean, you could say they are. He's saying that they're not. They're some separate issues. One's cognitive memory and the other one is some kind of like broken biological impulse. It's a separate idea, I think, is what he's getting at. The humans can be handed a identity and reject that identity, and that these other creatures, you know, they cannot, they have no choice to reject their identity. They are not capable. I think that's kind of what he's saying. That's why they're broken and we're not. And they need what we have. They need the ability to define themselves.
Yes.
Even in bad ways.
I'm just saying the premise of the movie is humans historically unbroken is not really resonating with me.
Okay.
I mean, come on, Craig.
I don't think that's the premise, though. I think you're missing the premise intentionally. So it's all
the
right.
The whole point is this guy, he gets implanted with the same thing that John Murdoch has, the same amount because it's John Murdoch's injection.
Yes.
And he can't help himself but to go quick kill, right? Because he's been given this identity, these urges, this desire to go do something. And you're telling me that the great benchmark of being human is that we don't give in to our urges.
No, you keep saying urges. It's not about urges. The actual line in the movie, "we are more than the sum of our memories," is listed. The only thing they can control are memories, right? They can rewrite your memories. The aliens,
impulses, or anything.
The strangers are only the sum of their collective memories, right? Whereas we are not only the sum of our collective memories. We do have urges, and his is to not kill. So when they give him the memories of a killer, he automatically rejects that, right?
Because he doesn't want to do it.
Because it's just not in his nature. He's saying there's a nature beyond what our memories are that we are assumed. I don't know that that's a question that needed to be thought about. It's like that's weird. You're thinking about some real heady stuff there, boss. But like that is the point of the movie, I guess. You know, he's trying to define humanity as being. I mean, there might be an argument to be made that like this is a anti-Soviet film or an anti-communist film or something like that because of some kind of rejection of collectivism in favor of individualism. And that's what the strangers are here to find, is the understand individualism. I don't know. So it was directed by Alex Proyas. I think he also wrote it.
Uh-huh.
Other people were also credited. David S. Goyer, The Dark Knight. But Alex Proyas had previously directed The Crow. This was his follow-up to The Crow. The man is goth director king. I don't know his background. Is he like a refugee from some Soviet country? Because a lot of times these kinds of themes will turn up in the works of those guys, people.
Yeah, we never got to the film facts.
Alex Proyas does not look like what I imagined.
We'll put it on screen. I'm not looking at him. So.
Wow. So he was born, he was Egypt to Greek parents. He's Greek Egyptian. So like Coptic or something, you know, like Cleopatra's Greek. His father's family had lived in Egypt for many generations, and his mother's family were from Cyprus. He moved to Sydney when he was 3. Huh. He did Australian film, television, radio school, and directed some MTV music videos and TV commercials thereafter. Then he did The Crow and other stuff. Yeah, I looked up his film history. It's a lot of like concert films and stuff. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I guess he has a lot of it's interesting too, though, because like he did Gods of Egypt. A movie about Egyptian mythology, about like literally myths of Egypt, and is nominated for Golden Raspberries for Worst Picture and Worst Director. I think it was largely panned because the cast is very white.
Of this movie?
Of Gods of Egypt.
Oh, also of this movie.
True. That is true. Yeah. And
yeah.
I mean, there's not any black. There's nobody in this movie who's non-white, right?
Also, how do the strangers procreate? There's a child stranger. There's no female strangers.
So there are no children strangers. They tell you flat out, these are your corpses. They take the corpses of humans and inhabit them and pilot them. Weird ghost spider that comes out is the stranger.
They only pilot men.
That's true.
It's just an observation. Okay. It's just such a sophomoric movie.
Sure, I think is.
Like that's my problem. It's just like, okay. Like he's a big fan. It's interesting that Richard O'Brien, who plays Mr. Hand, like the main stranger, is Rocky Horror Picture Show. And he wanted him for this role. He loves Rocky Horror Picture Show. So it's just like, things that are weird, but Rocky Horror Picture Show is interesting and weird. I don't know. We'll keep
Richard O'Brien, he wrote Rocky Horror too. He wasn't just in it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's like, Richard O'Brien is not just in Rocky Horror. He's the creator of it.
Okay.
Yeah. He's Riff Raff. It's funny. I kept looking at him thinking, is that Alan Cummings? Mr. Hand.
Do they look alike?
Mr. Hand does. Mr. Hand looks kind of a lot like Alan Cummings a couple of times.
Oh, interesting. I didn't catch that, but.
To me. And then I looked up, I was like, oh, it's Richard O'Brien. Wow.
So, okay. So yeah. All right. He's searching for Shell Beach. He also sort of breaks the veil over the detective that's been chasing him, and they sort of now are working together.
Yeah. Well, because he asks him the question about daytime and it blows his mind. And then they go to find Shell Beach with Dr. Schreiber, and they find out that it's just outer space.
Right. Which Schreiber knows because he's there. They start to break through the wall and he's telling them not to. And they discover outer space. And then the detective, why can't I keep his name in my head?
William Hurt is the actor.
Frank Bumstead.
What a terrible name.
He gets sucked into outer space.
Yeah, him and a stranger. They tumble out into outer space forever.
Which I was going to say, like, this is what sets us into sort of like total fantasy for, you know, it's like, we are somewhere else. We are in a floating city with aliens, probably not even alien, with these other creatures that exist in the middle of nowhere in outer space.
Oh, yeah. It gets real dorky. I will say, though, I mean, like, I feel like the Matrix and this movie have a lot in common. You know, you live in a dream world controlled by maleficent creatures that need something that is unique about you for their own survival. In the movie, The Matrix, they claim they're using them for batteries. And in this, it's like, we got to figure out your soul in a highly stylized setting. And when you find out the truth about that setting, you'll have special powers.
Yeah. I guess The Matrix is born out of our own world. So I guess it's a little easier to understand. Like, it's a future Earth.
Well, it opens in a world that you would recognize immediately.
Right.
The Matrix, like, the Matrix looks like our world. This looks like, where the hell am I? This is some weird noir,
dark
40s kind of vibe thing. There is actually, I was just thinking about the replacement guy at the front desk of the hotel is black. One black actor in the film.
Wow.
Just remember that. So it is very white. It's too white. No question. We'll have to do a remake, a colorblind remake or something, or maybe not. I don't think you do.
No, I don't think we need to remake.
No, you don't think we need a remake of Dark City? Why not? How about a sequel?
So he doesn't learn how to harness his powers. That's right. Kiefer Sutherland injects him with
memories, training memories. So he has this power to tune. It's never explained why he can tune, but he can tune. And the strangers think it's kind of insane that a human would develop the ability to tune. And it's kind of like, it's a raw talent. He can't quite tune as well as the rest of them. So in the climax, Kiefer is supposed to like erase his brain or whatever, or inject him with like some, he's going to inject John with the collective memories of the strangers.
That's right. So he knows how to do it. So that
they migrate into his soul and save themselves. But instead he injects them with specially made memories where it's his whole life, except Kiefer Sutherland is always in it, training him how to tune.
Yeah, that's right. He's like, it gets very 1950s picket fence. Like, hey, young man.
Yes, there's a couple of great beats like that. I like at one point, he's like, you may notice I'm in a lot of your memories. It's because I put myself in here. It's like, think about it. Like, from his perspective, this is how he grew up. He grew up this strange man just continually showing up and teaching him secret brain tricks. Don't tell anyone. And so then he wakes up with all of the powers to tune. The thing is, like, you start swapping somebody's memories around, right? Like, this is what I think we get into a Total Recall. Who is John Murdoch, right?
Yeah, we don't really know. He just...
No, but I mean, like, in that moment, he is trying to get free this whole movie. He's trying to get to Shell Beach. He's trying to understand himself. He's trying to reunite with his wife. And then in that last scene, we give him all new memories so that he can save the day.
Or are they additional memories? It doesn't seem like he wipes him. He just adds to him.
So we could say somehow. That.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, would that even be him anymore? I guess the movie is saying it would, because humans are not their memories. We are more than our memories. We're magic things. And the aliens are only their memories. They are not magic things. They are awful things. I guess that's what he's saying.
Sure. So now he has the power to manipulate the world however he wants.
Say it. Say the word.
To tune the world however he wants. And he floods the outer atmosphere with water.
Yes.
It seems to me like I interpreted this as he's going to...
Blue sky on Mars.
Yeah, he's going to create an atmosphere and create a planet, more or less.
Then you have to ask the question, was there ever an Earth before this?
We don't know. It's unknowable.
He's God making the Earth.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe this is how we all got here in the first place.
Yeah. One thing that I thought was fucked up is that they made Dr. Schreiber erase his own memories, which he did so that he could live. But also, that is suicide.
Yeah, sure.
Wouldn't that just be dying, like erasing all of your experiences up to this point and hitting reset? You're just new person.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know anything about who he is except for his ability to tinker with other people's memories.
And Jennifer Connelly loses her memory of being his wife at some point too.
Yeah, and they have to meet each other a second time. And I think that's a little bit like that Eternal Sunshine plot point, which is like, you can erase your memories of me all you want, but like, we're fated to be together, right? Like, we are two people who are going to find each other again and again.
Which, I don't know why, because I don't feel any sort of chemistry or anything between the two of them.
Well, I like Rufus Sewell, but he is a man incapable of chemistry. He is an ice cold individual. There's no warmth ever coming off of that man in anything I've ever seen him. But it is very compelling anyway. Actually, that's not entirely true. Did you ever watch any of Man in the High Castle?
I haven't, no.
It's not good. It's bad.
Oh, okay. I thought you liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man in the High Castle is two shows happening at the same time. There is a show that stars some older veteran actors that's very interesting. And I can't remember everybody's names, but one of them is Rufus Sewell. And that's like a pretty good show. At the same time, there is a show of younger actors who seem to live in a WB, like teen drama romance, but with Nazis. And that feels very, very, very bad. And unfortunately, the main plot line is the second one.
Oh, okay.
So the main character is this young girl from San Francisco, young woman from San Francisco. That storyline is only good when it intersects the storyline that centers on the older people. It's real bad. Otherwise it's hard to watch. And it went so many seasons. I got through seasons 1 and 2 of that show. And then season 3, I fell asleep repeatedly trying to watch but no, I have to say, I don't know what else he's been in, but like, he's actually, I got some thunder going on here. He's actually quite, human in that he's a Nazi and he's a bastard. But then you find out that, well, one, he's an American soldier who became a Nazi when the Nazis won World War II in this setting. And two, he really loves his family, and there's a lot of like, holy shit, like, this bed we lie in, we got to walk a tightrope and ultimately, like, his kid who has been raised in this, environment of permanent, like, you know, Nazi propaganda ends up turning himself in for disposal because he has some like congenital heart defect that means he'll never grow up to be much. And so he's like, well, I don't want to be a useless eater, dad. So, and dad tries like hell to get him off to like someplace where he'd be safe. But the kid just derails all of those plans by saying, I'm just going to go to the processing facility and have myself killed. There's some heavy shit in that.
That's dark.
Yeah, and he carries it off. He carries it off quite well. You believe you know, so I'm only doing all of this to say I said the man is ice cold and has no chemistry, but yeah. I don't think that's true. He's got an actual human soul, just like the humans in Dark City.
Yeah, I know him from A Knight's Tale, which is also kind of a dark, unlikable guy in that movie.
He plays the Black Prince in it, right?
Yeah, but yeah.
He's kind of an 11th hour hero.
Does it, at the end?
He's like a good guy in it.
I don't think so. I don't remember. I haven't seen Knight's Tale in years.
If I'm not mistaken, there's a big deal in it that like he is trying to joust, but nobody will joust him because they're afraid of killing the future heir. And the only person who will joust him is Heath Ledger's character. And that is a huge...
No, that's a different guy. This is the guy. He's like cheating to win the tournament.
Oh, he's the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Oh, you're right. That
he's fighting with Heath Ledger over the girl. Yeah. He thinks and he's betrothed to her. He's supposed to have her.
And he makes for a great villain. He does.
Oh, yeah. He carries does. It off he would well. Be a very
You're
good
right.
villain.
The other guy, I forget that actor's name now, but he knights Heath Ledger mm-hmm. in, as a reward, right. which
so
makes
that
him
he can,
valid. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. That makes much more sense.
Yeah.
Thank you. So you hated this, and now I'm compelled to defend it against you. Even though I was deeply embarrassed that I even made you watch it.
Look, I don't hate it. Since you're defending it, I'm falling further on the fight against it sort of side. I think, like, it's too, I can't get to this stretch of imagination. Like, there's something about how humans in my mind are and work, and they're not questioning the things that I believe humans would question. Like, they're not
okay
acting human to me. They're acting in this very specific way for this very specific plot.
Yeah. No,
and
totally.
They just have to stay right there or else it all falls apart.
It did, on my rewatch of this, it did feel like I was watching like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It felt less like a movie about human beings and more like Greek theater or something, where like there's mm-hmm. these archetypes who are presenting their perspective to the audience. You know, like it just seems, or like Kabuki or something. Like you're right. Like they don't seem human. They seem like weird archetypes.
And when the director was like questioned about the Walensky character, which is the former detective who's now become aware and he's trying to ride subways to get out to Shell Beach. He's like lost his mind. Like, why wouldn't these characters just dispose of him? This is a dangerous thing in their world. And he's like, oh, he's an experiment. They want to see what he'll do, what a human will do when they realize this. And it's like, yeah, I guess that's your catch-all sort of way for all these plot holes to be fixed. Oh, it's just an experiment. Oh, they're experimenting. Like,
yeah.
There's not a reason for it. He doesn't know why.
No, there's
he
not.
He needed someone that in a pivotal moment, John could communicate with.
Right. Exactly. Oh man, we should do that one too. Sorry. I was just thinking of another movie from like roughly this time frame. We'll save that one for Halloween. You ever see Fallen?
Mm-mm.
You got to see that movie. And don't look up anything about it. The less you know, the better. It's just a good flick. It's a good movie about a cop. That's all there is to it. It's just a good old mystery. But yeah, it does feel like something I would have drawn up in my like 3-ring binder in sophomore year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking my players are going to love this. right. You know? So it does. That's why I say it's kind of cringe inducing for me.
Right. Well, and for like where I get with the female characters is like all of the female characters are gratuitous in this movie. Like,
oh yeah,
you've got
real male gazy.
Yeah, they're there to show their boobs and be prostitutes, or they're there to sing in sexy nightclubs and be
sure
like an idealized 16-year-old's wife. Sexy and mysterious and, you know, whatever. And that's it. That is the entire extent of, oh, wow.
There's quite the storm happening out here. Oh, my goodness. Saw some scary close lightning out there. But I heard what you're saying. 16-year-old wife. Yeah, I got you. No, absolutely. And as a 16-year-old, Jennifer Connelly. Hey.
Right. So like I can understand why.
I've been crushing on her since I was seven, you know?
There's not much for me to connect to in this movie or be
so
interested in.
Yeah, fair enough. So she's not your type is what you're saying.
Well, and I dig the mystery. I dig the moment that, you know, he wakes up, he's trying to figure out who he is. Like, I don't inherently have a problem with the movie. It's just as he starts to solve this mystery, I'm not satisfied by any of the answers.
This is the problem that I think a lot of real high concept movies have, which is where the third act, ultimately, everything cool you've been building is kind of a mystery because we don't know what's in the box. And then in the third act, when you start to pull it apart and see what's really happening, it's not as good as not knowing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem with a lot of movies like this. So it has the third act problem hardcore for sure, because ultimately we get the dumbest shit ever, which is just like a tune fight between him and the other tuners while they tune around the city, tuning back and forth at each other.
Well, and an argument for The Matrix is they do the opposite of that. They give you act one of mystery, and then they tell you what's happening,
true,
and then
you
live
everything.
The rest of the movie in that world and trying to understand that world. And the world makes sense.
Sort of.
I mean, aside from the energy not working the way it would work or not being necessarily needed or necessary and actually taking more energy than it creates, sure. But the concept of this alternate world existing and why makes sense.
I'll say that it's internally consistent. I don't think it's any more internally consistent, though, than Dark City, because if the premise, we have to take it at face value, right? Like the movie's central premise is that humans are not like these creatures because of X, Y, and Z. These creatures have these powers. Then I don't think that there's a lack of internal consistency in this setting. I don't know.
Are humans in this movie?
That may be true. And I do want to say too, is that like this movie is so, it has such a heightened aesthetic, and it does take place at no time. You know, it takes place in some non-real, you know what I mean? Like it's not even trying to be the real world.
Right.
To your
thing.
Point about like, this isn't how humans would behave. I guess I'm usually very hardcore about that. I think that in this film, I accept it. Again, cringe inducing film. I don't want to overly defend it, but in movies like this, I am more likely to look past that stuff with ease because, okay, we're not even going for reality here. We are in some alternate heightened reality. Period films often, I think, get away with that.
Sure.
Like, I don't know how people spoke or interacted in the 60s. So Mad Men feels very authentic to me. Maybe it's not.
Right. Or like Pee Wee Herman does that, but in a different way.
Establishes a world where that isn't. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, none of those people are acting how humans would act, or they're given very strict guidelines as to what this human is.
Yeah, but inside of the confines of the world that's established, they behave perfectly normally.
Sure.
They make perfect sense.
I'll give you that.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, a movie probably missed by a lot of people, and maybe it should stay missed.
And the reason we revisited it is because we were going to do an episode on The Matrix, and there was this movie that was very compared to, or other way around, The Matrix was compared to it.
I made that comparison. Yeah, I was
well,
like...
Well, but it's been made many... Yeah. You're not the only... Yeah, it's been made.
I think it's right to be made.
Yeah.
But you think The Matrix is the better film? It's certainly the one that had the bigger impact.
Yeah. I'm curious if this stood out to you. Sorry, something I wrote down in the like facts, which I find like this did not occur to me while watching the movie. I'm surprised by that, is that it has one of the shortest average shot lengths of any modern narrative, and it's cutting every 1.8 seconds.
It didn't jump out at me.
I didn't feel like it was fast cutty at all. Like, I think of Baz Luhrmann as like fast cutty, like always cutting. Like, I did not feel that way about this movie.
So there's two different ways to cut. He's just cutting invisible. Baz Luhrmann wants you to know when he cuts.
Right.
It's a different kind of thing. Yeah, and he might even be cutting slower as a result of that.
Maybe.
Here, you're just doing what's called like golden cinema cuts, you know, golden age cutting, which is invisible cuts, but like fast, really fast, I guess, which is cool. I don't know. It didn't even jump out at me. Maybe one or twice, two scenes, but not really. And, you know, he's a guy who did a lot of music videos. So that kind of makes a lot of sense. I was going to say, I do love the effects in it. A lot of them don't hold up. The weird wavy blue lines look silly as hell.
Yeah, but the like, city moving is
It's so cool. Like the twisting buildings growing and stuff like that. And like pushing out the walls in that room. Like I thought that was gonna look like shit and revisiting it. But I was like, damn, that looks great. Actually, that looks really cool.
It does look cool. It looks natural. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very believable.
A lot of miniatures in this and they carry off quite well, I think.
Yep. Agreed. I would not knock it for like visual effects or that type of taking you out of it at all.
It's just corny.
It's just corny.
It's just real corny.
It's also like, I think like noirs live in a period of time where noirs make sense.
Yes.
And I think like when you try to be a noir for a stylistic reason, it just doesn't come off the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. Well, and
Blade Runner is maybe an exception, but that's being cyberpunk, not noir. It just feels noir.
Well,
maybe.
It is neo-noir. And I was going to say that this movie totally fits the archetype and confines of neo-noir because he is in search literally for himself. He doesn't know his memories. He's trying to figure out who he is and what that means to be that person. Or is he not that person? Blade Runner is about that too. But the difference is that Deckard never really admits that that's what he's looking for. He won't ever admit that to himself. He knows what he's looking for, but he doesn't want to think about it.
Right.
Whereas here, the character is obsessed with figuring himself out. And as well, you would be. But so it's totally neo-noir. It's just that they jam the aesthetics of noir into it.
Yeah.
Without need.
Well, and I guess we didn't really go through like the facts of the movie and we don't need to go through them all now. I think we've talked about it, but it was a critically acclaimed, but it was a theatrical flop.
Yeah.
With a budget of $27 million, it grossed $14 million domestically and $27 million worldwide.
Well, just like the critics, us erudite teenagers really got it, and you plebs simply weren't ready for it. Maybe the masses will come around on this one sometime down the road.
18, 19-year-old me really liked this movie as well. I really enjoyed it the first time I saw it, but thinking about it, trying to find it for a while, so it can't all be bad.
I'm reading your notes right here. I like way Kiefer talks in this movie makes all of his scenes unwatchable. I agree. I agree. I fully agree. You said yeah. The nightclub singing scenes are just
very astute note taking.
I would love to hear again what the replacement voice sounded like, because I remember watching it and I was like, I made my wife watch it with me, and I was like, I don't remember her singing this bad. Like, like it jumped out at me, and I'm not like that musical. So I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah. I also did what I will give it this caveat on my way out. I watched this movie while I was slipping into being just absolutely ravaged by the COVID vaccine.
Oh.
So I watched it probably in 20-minute increments because I kept like getting fevers and falling asleep.
You went and got vaccinated recently, huh?
And we're going on a cruise.
Oh, okay.
And I am pregnant.
Okay, fair enough.
So booster seemed like the smart choice.
Yeah, well advised.
Yeah.
I said that, I want to see the director's cut of this because I think that that's like a big deal. And my wires are crossed. It's the director's cut, or really the black and white cut of Johnny Mnemonic, which is a movie that was directed by William Gibson, starring Keanu Reeves. And it's based on a short story William Gibson wrote in Burning Chrome, which is the collection of short stories he put out before Neuromancer was released. So like this is cyberpunk case 001 or whatever, directed by the guy who wrote it. And it's a goofy, corny movie that we should probably do.
Sure.
But I would love to see it in black and white as he intended. He wanted to shoot it in black and white and the studio wouldn't let him. And I'd be curious to see his black and white version. I've heard it's much more compelling.
Okay. Well, I like, we'll see how this, we'll see how lesser known movies perform on the podcast.
I don't know that this is lesser known. I don't know about Neuromancer. I think Neuromancer looms large.
It's just a different audience. Yeah. It's a specific audience.
Gentlemen of my generation, I guarantee they all know what it is.
Okay.
Not Neuromancer, sorry. Johnny Mnemonic. Neuromancer would be great to see as a movie, but it'll never be adapted. And many of its scenes from the book were stolen wholesale for, what's the movie where they go inside of people's dreams? The movie with DiCaprio and they're in the dreams and they put stuff in.
Oh, Inception.
Inception. It's like Neuromancer through a lens darkly.
All right. That is it. That has been Dark City.
This was Dark City through a city darkly. Darkly through my city.
A big shout out and thank you to Annie Villalobos for producing the show.
Thanks, Annie. Thank you so much to Heather Vaughn, our creator of artwork and the creator of many artworks. And you should check her out on the places she's at. I was going to say Twitter, but I guess she's on X now.
Also maybe Instagram. We should figure out if there's any places she wants us to shout out.
We should.
Thank you to Studio 71.
Thank you, Studio 71. And Epidemic Sound, we are still waiting for your thank you note. So
exactly,
when we get it,
I assume it's in the mail.
We assume maybe lost in the mail. We'll send you our new address.
Exactly. All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. See you next time on Midnight Local.